I'm Bob Slidell. This is my associate, Bob Porter.
Hi, Bob. Bob?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
This is heavy duty, Doc. This is great. Does it run like on regular unleaded gasoline?
Unfortunately, no. It requires something with a little more kick. Plutonium.
Plutonium. Wait a minute. Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?
I was taking a look at some of your previous interviews that you've done in other places, Robert Hastings, and I saw that you had an interview with Atomic Energy Commission Supervisor Chet Lytle, in 1998, and he had some interesting revelations in that, and I don't believe we talked about that on our previous interview, so why don't you talk a little bit about this interview you had with Chet Lytle?
I've got a whole chapter in my book on this, but to summarize, Chet Lytle worked for the Atomic Energy Commission for many years. His first involvement with nuclear weapons was during World War II. He was an engineer involved with the Manhattan Project, which created the first atomic bombs. His company created the explosive lenses, as they were called, which would focus the nuclear part of the detonation into, basically there were two halves of a uranium or plutonium core that had to be fused together to create a critical mass for a nuclear chain reaction. To do that, what Chet created were little lenses of high explosive that would detonate electronically all at once to create this fusion. So he also, after the war, worked for the CIA, for the Department of Defense, Department of Energy on many contracts involving technical related issues. In any case, in 1990, I was introduced to him by Kevin Randall, the Roswell researcher, and Don Schmidt, who was his partner at the time. Mm-hmm. And during the course of this dinner, Chet just kind of nonchalantly whispered in my ear, "I know about some nuclear weapons-related UFO cases." So I pestered him to interview, to allow me to interview him. He held me at arm's length for 9 years. He basically felt he had said too much or didn't want to say it any more than that. But eventually he consented to being interviewed. I did go to his offices in Albuquerque and clipped a microphone on his tie and talked to him for 2 hours. And most of what he told me was incidents involving UFO sightings at atomic or nuclear thermonuclear weapons sites, including at the Nevada test site. But in the course of this conversation, he suddenly let it drop that he had been personal friends with William Blanchard, who was the colonel and the base commander of the Roswell Army Airfield when this object crashed in July of 47. And according to Lytle, he was pretty good friends with then later on General Blanchard. And apparently in February of 53, they were in Alaska together doing nuclear weapons-related work. And in the course of one conversation, Blanchard just told Chet Lytle that indeed this was a crashed alien spaceship, that 4 bodies had been recovered. And, I was startled by all of this, but he went on to say on tape that this indeed took place. He further said that in the course of his job with the Atomic Energy Commission at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, actually it was Wright-Patterson at that point in the early 50s, the wife of his military aide actually worked as the secretary for the general who was involved with keeping the craft and the bodies under wraps. And after he went on tape with all of this, I tried to press him for some names, names of the people, and that's where he drew the line. About a year later, maybe close to 2 years later, I went to ask him, tried to ask him follow-up questions. He basically said, "I can't tape this conversation." I reminded him that he allowed me to do the previous one, and he said to me, "After you and I met Mr. Hastings, I was paid a visit. I was warned not to discuss any of thing involving Roswell or UFOs in general with either you or Mr. Schmidt." Mr. Lytle would not tell me who visited him, what affiliation, whether this was military, CIA, he wouldn't tell me. And basically said, I've still got contracts with the government. I don't want to screw it up for myself or my son, who now runs the company. And that was the end of it.
Yeah.
So I set up interviews with him over the phone. I'm assuming that someone got wind, probably by monitoring my phone, that I was going to be speaking with him, and just more or less leaned on him not to repeat the error that he made.
Well, I guess it's just lucky that you got your stuff while you did then, I guess,
Yep. Yeah, it's on tape.
Yeah, so, we pulled a fast one on them there, I guess, right?
It's cash as cash can't, whatever you can get, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Well, how'd the whole Larry King interview even come about in the first place? Because it seems like the media is pretty not interested in even getting into the nuclear thing, probably because they know that it would freak people out pretty badly. So I'm surprised that you even got a shot at Larry King. So how'd that even come about?
In January of 2008, there were a number of sightings in Stevensville, Texas. I was giving a lecture there about a month later, and Larry King's staff got wind of the lecture, contacted me. I could not give an interview that night because of the program I was doing, but I had them call Bob Salas. Bob went on by himself late January of 08, and then I had ongoing contacts with Larry King's producer and told her about what I was up to, and she had me and Bob. Well, she basically gave me a blank check to bring on anyone I wanted to, so I picked Bob Salas, Bob Jameson, and Dr. Bob Jacobs, all ex-Air Force personnel officers, to come on with me and talk about nuclear weapons cases. So that was the chain of the events.
You'll probably get into this in a minute, Bob. I'm going to ask you, what was it like for you going on the Larry King show? Robert just said you went on solo once. What's Larry like, and did you get any sort of indication how he felt? Because I've always sort of thought that, especially lately in the last couple of years, that, he's kind of on our side in a little bit. I think he really wants to sort of push the UFO story and try and get into this. But, I mean, you had interaction with him. So what was that like?
Right. Yeah, I talked to Larry off camera for quite a while. And Larry is very interested in this subject. My sense is that he's pretty much a believer that there's something going on here. Of course, but he's a showman. And one of my objections about the way they produced his show is that they've got these cartoonish type things showing UFOs in kind of a laughable way. But that's part of the showmanship, part of the show. And the other aspect to it, of course, is that on the Larry King show, he usually has the skeptics on and a whole series of witnesses or other people that only get small sound bites, and we don't get an opportunity to really go in depth into our stories. But far as Larry King himself goes, I really enjoyed he's got a high interest in this subject, and I really enjoyed being on his shows two times.
I was just going to reiterate what Bob said. There's, unfortunately, the producers feel they have to have on multiple witnesses, multiple persons, and so everyone gets just a few words. There's no follow-up. You don't really get to present a cohesive case. Now, there has been tentative interest expressed by his staff. I won't get into the details in having Bob and I and some of the press conference participants on. In September, we were actually supposed to be on the week before Michael Jackson died, and when he died, everything was canceled, so Bob and I would have already been on twice. In any case, I'm hoping that we will be on in the fall. I just read yesterday, apparently Larry King is retiring this fall.
Yeah, I just was going to ask that, yeah, so
We may have a limited opportunity, and I suspect that everybody and his brother, dealing with every subject under the sun, are trying to get on during his last few episodes. So who knows? But we'll see.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be a lot of Lady Gaga and LeBron James. So if he can trump those two, then you're in good shape. As we've sort of established here, in the 60s, in Bob's specific incident, they shut down the missiles. Now, kind of like to throw it to what I had said earlier about if the reaction in the chain of command has changed, has the, for lack of a better term, reaction of the missiles changed over the years? Like, are they still able to shut them down or mess with the controls of them, or is that something that the military may have been able to figure out a way around based on, the witnesses you've talked to?
Okay, well, the only thing I think I can interject on that is we've found out that as of 1972, which was, 5 years after the incident, the Air Force was still involved in looking at the causes for the Echo and Oscar shutdowns. And I get this from a good source. He was at a particular base where this investigation was still ongoing, and the Air Force was still trying to figure out how to modify the weapon systems, the missiles, so that this wouldn't occur again. Now, Whether or not they've succeeded, your guess is as good as mine. I got out of the Air Force in 1971, and so I've had no official contact with the Air Force.
What about you, Robert? Based on the people you've talked to, does it sound like these the tinkering with the weapons is still going on, or is that something that maybe, like I said, you know, like maybe the military's figured out a way to shield the weapons from any interference like that?
I have heard from a former launch officer who was at F.E. Warren in 1993-94 about repeated UFO incursions and rumors, but nothing more, rumors of missiles being impacted in terms of their functionality. But he was not directly involved, and so I could not say, you know, with any degree of confidence that that was taking place, but the rumors certainly were ongoing. I happened to be at Malmstrom last November 2009 for the first time since 67 when my dad was stationed there. I hadn't been on the base in all those years. In any case, in the company of a retired missile maintenance guy, whose name I won't mention, I had a conversation with an active duty security policeman who said that there was a UFO sighting that he personally witnessed at Oscar Flight, where Bob was 40 years earlier, sometime in 2007. However, because he is active duty, or was as of last November, I told him I didn't really want to pursue this and potentially jeopardize his career, and hopefully he will contact me. We have contact information for each other. Hopefully he'll be in touch after he leaves the Air Force. So there's this frustrating built-in delay where people feel they have to wait decades, and I can't blame them to come forward and talk about all this. So what you tend to hear about more recent incidents are simply the basic report, a sighting of a UFO by, you know, civilians and or military people at a given site. But as far as locating people who could tell you much about what happened, it's probably years on average before they'll, you know, I'll just locate them by happenstance or, you know, sheer dumb luck.
Yeah.
And my opinion is that I doubt seriously that the Air Force has solved this problem completely. And the reason I say that is because of a story I heard from another witness who doesn't want to become known, but he's very credible. He's another targeting officer, and he was working on the missile, I think one of Echo Flight's missiles, trying to bring it back up to alert status. He was down in the missile tube, had a guard upstairs. The guard shakes the ladder going down to the missile bay, where the maintenance bay where he's working. And he's scared to death. He asks this fellow to come up, and he comes up the ladder and sees this bright orange globe-type object hovering above the site. The guard's scared to death. The guy that's working, this witness, looks at it and says, "Wow," and then goes back down the ladder. And I asked him why he wasn't so scared. He said, "I don't know," but he went back down, continued his procedures to bring the missile back up on alert status. And he said he was going through his procedures, and he could feel kind of this static electricity in the air. It was a palpable electrical feeling coming down the tube. And every time he'd get to a particular point in his checklist, the missile would go down again. In other words, he couldn't complete the proper tests, and he kept doing this over and over many times, and again, when he got to a particular point in the checklist, it would shut down again. And to me, this points to the fact, and he pointed this out to me too, that whatever these objects are, they know very well how our systems work, how the missile systems work in great detail. So my guess is the Air Force has not been able to solve this problem completely.
Yeah, okay. Now, at the risk of getting too speculative, what do you think is the motivation behind these craft, if you will? Are they just, I mean, I can understand sort of flying over and sort of doing, you know, reconnaissance and surveillance of the missile sites and stuff, but tinkering with the controls and everything else seems dangerous to the point where you wonder why they would even do that. If it's is it inadvertent on their part? Doesn't sound like it. you know, are they shutting them down to send a message? I've heard stories where they activate them. So it's, you know, not, I mean, so I'm confused as I'm sure we all are. So I guess, you know, what's your speculation on what this is all about?
Yeah, I'll take it first, I guess. My speculation, and again, it's just speculation, is that they're just trying to send us a message. They obviously, their technology is far, far advanced of ours, and they probably could have done a lot of damage to our weapon systems, but they didn't. All they chose to do in my case was simply to disable them temporarily. They were brought back up within a day, about a day, I guess. And it was simply a message, I think, to let us know that we have to eliminate our nuclear weapons. That's the conclusion I've come to from just thinking about this over the years. Robert?
That's my opinion as well. I think based on the statements I've gotten from over 120 people who were involved in one incident or another in one capacity or another, three quarters of them do believe that these are beings from somewhere else who are wagging a finger at us and the Russians and probably other nuclear missile powers, weapons powers, saying basically, you know, that you're playing with fire. You know, if you actually go through with your threats and use these things against each other, you could risk human civilization being destroyed and screwing up the planet for a long, long time with radioactivity. So I think that's what's going on. And the fact, you know, people have said to me, well, how come they don't just land on the White House lawn or in the Kremlin courtyard and say, you know, we're here, we're real, we don't want you to have nukes, get rid of them. The fact that that has not taken place tells me there's a larger agenda. I think ultimately whoever they are intend open contact with humankind. They realize that if they suddenly do it in one fell swoop, there could be adverse consequences, whereas if they slowly over several decades allow themselves to be seen in the sky, you know, on an ongoing basis, more and more people get used to the idea that they're real and they're here. But at some point they'll, you know, make no doubt about that in anyone's mind by doing something, or some collective government announcement around the world will admit that this is real. But in the meantime, given the way that the Cold War went and the development of nuclear weapons after World War II, I think the potential for human catastrophe and planetary destruction just went through the roof, and whoever these guys are who have been watching us probably for thousands of years decided that they needed at this crucial point in human history to kind of step in on a low-key, covert basis, you know, out in the countryside in Montana and dunk a few nukes and send a message to the Pentagon, or dunk a few nukes in Soviet Ukraine and send a message to the Kremlin. And, you know, at the time this goes on, very few people know about it because of all the military secrecy. So they make their point, these guys in the UFOs make their point to both Washington and Moscow without large numbers of people around the world being realizing that this is going on. If it weren't for courageous people like Mr. Salas and, you know, pain in the asses like myself who feel this needs to be talked about, you know, public wouldn't know about this. I mean, very few people have known about these documents that I alluded to about UFO activity in the 40s. Those have been in the public domain for 30 years. Probably not one in a million Americans know about them.
To take the speculation a little bit further then, now I'm no student of the history of nuclear proliferation, but I have a feeling that either one of you guys probably knows, I'm sure that either one of you guys knows more about it than I do. So I guess the question, as I said, to keep it in the speculative realm, is has there been any sort of government reaction to this message? I mean, have we had a downgrading in the number of nuclear weapons? I know we're interested in keeping Iran and North Korea from getting nuclear weapons, but, you know, has there been any sort of sign that the government's leaning away from nuclear weapons, that maybe we could draw the dotted line to these warnings, if you will?
Well, of course, yeah, this is really speculative because, of course, nuclear policy is it's not classified. I guess the policy is open, but whether or not this has had an effect in government, I like to believe it has. There was the total number of nukes has peaked. I think it peaked in the I'm going to say the 80s, maybe. And since then, there's a good website. Atomic Scientists. It's called something like that.
Mm-hmm. Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Yeah, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Thank you, Robert. It has graphics that shows a definite decrease in the total number of nuclear weapons. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there's less of a hazard, because the number of nuclear states has increased, is increasing.
Yeah.
And as you know, Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons. Israel, which doesn't claim to have them, but they do have nuclear weapons.
Right.
And Iran's trying to get them. So that's the real worry. It's not the number, total number, but and then again, we've got a political situation in Congress. The Senate hasn't ratified this agreement between Russia and the United States yet, and who knows whether or not the Senate will ratify it. It's those kinds of things that I think should make all of us nervous, and again, that's another motivation for me personally to try to get word out on this. Let's get behind the idea of going for abolishment of nuclear weapons, which I think President Obama has iterated.
Yeah, I think that is one of his big...
I would simply add that if you look at human history and how wars have started, there are so many times where in the most bizarre, unpredictable manner, suddenly you've got millions of people dying because somebody misinterpreted the other guys. They thought they were going to do this, so they did a preemptive strike, or there was just a lot of miscommunication involved. I've got a whole chapter in my book that talks about nuclear near misses in the last 30-some years, where for one stupid reason or another, either we or the Russians almost pushed the button and started World War III until at the last moment. I mean, sometimes it came down to like 3 minutes. Someone realized a training tape exercise was put into the computer at NORAD, and these weren't really nuclear missiles coming over the pole. I mean, that's straight out of the movie War Games, but that actually happened at NORAD, I forget the date, 84. In any case, that has happened at least 20 times between us and the Soviets. So the point is, as long as nuclear weapons exist, there's always a potential for something going catastrophically wrong. I would also add that, it's not said publicly, but any power like Russia or America who has large numbers, they want to keep them because their strategists think it enhances their ability to throw their weight around the world to control situations. But at the same time, they hypocritically say that other states shouldn't have at least, one or two pitiful nuclear weapons. Obviously there's a great deal of hypocrisy, and just ignoring the fact that as long as we have them and feel it's justifiable and Russia feels it's justifiable, how can we say and expect these other little dinky countries to not build their one or two bombs? It's just not going to happen if we can, unless we just, take the moral high ground and lead the way to nuclear disarmament.
Exactly, yeah. Now, we've talked about nuclear weapons and nuclear submarines. What about nuclear power plants? I've heard stories, surrounding Chernobyl, but have you heard any stories regarding nuclear power plants and UFOs?
I'll briefly say and then turn it over to Bob. I don't research those per se, but I have in the appendix, one of the appendices in my book, half a dozen cases, including the Chernobyl incident. I think Bob knows about that. He can address that for your listeners. In any case, yeah, there seems to be ongoing UFO interest in commercial power plants as well, both in the U.S. and abroad. And if one Googles, commercial power plants, nuclear power plants, UFOs, you'll see that there is a catalog of cases that suggests that pattern or that link.
Okay. Bob?
I'll mention two things. As far as Chernobyl goes, and I think we got this information recently from our friend in Russia, that there are witnesses that saw UFOs above Chernobyl even before the accident and after the accident. That's all I can really say about that. There supposedly are witnesses that have seen them there. The other thing I'll mention is that a few years ago, I went to Tucson, Arizona, University of Arizona, to look at the records of James McDonald, Dr. James McDonald.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I listened to a lot of his audio tapes, and he has interviewed a few witnesses who happened to be living near nuclear power plants, one in particular in the East Coast, who, again, saw UFOs over the power plant. So, again, it may be that they're just pointing to the danger of nuclear period, you know, nuclear materials, and that we have to be careful. And of course, we have a problem with storing nuclear materials now that are a result of, you know, generating in nuclear power plants.
Oh, like radioactive waste and stuff like that?
Radioactive waste, exactly, you know.
Yeah.
The story, the interesting thing about Chernobyl, in my understanding, is that in the early 90s, there were a couple of publications, one in Ukraine, one in the Soviet Union, actually it would have been Russia at that point, in which former nuclear radiation monitoring personnel came forward and talked about being at Chernobyl within an hour or two of the explosion of the reactor. Radiation is drifting across Ukraine all the way into, because of the winds, up into Scandinavia. And the story that was published in these two, the information published in these two stories was that radiation readings had been taken at the explosion site prior to the appearance of this UFO, and they were, I'm going to say, 4,000 millirentgens an hour. I think that's correct. In any case, after this spherical-shaped object, brass in color, appeared directly over the damaged reactor, according to this witness, shot down two crimson-colored beams of light into the damaged reactor, sped away. This all took about 3 to 5 minutes. They monitored the radiation again, and it had dropped by two-thirds. And the gist of the article was that these technical personnel involved with monitoring the situation could not explain in terms of scientific knowledge how radiation could drop that dramatically simply because of the appearance of this object. So those were the stories that circulated. And as Pop said, apparently there were sightings of UFOs at the site even before the explosion. So there seems to be a very interesting link in that case and others.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, very strange, very strange. And I know some people point to the Chernobyl thing and think that the ETs or whatever are going to stop any nuclear war if it breaks out. But I take it from you guys' opinion that we probably shouldn't rely on the ETs to stop a nuclear war if we're on the precipice of it, regardless of how they feel about nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah, I agree. We shouldn't depend on ETs stopping a nuclear war, and of course they can't be everywhere all the time, and
right. And
there may be some dirty bombs being developed, and even if there isn't a war, there could be serious damage from exploding dirty bombs in major cities.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Yeah,
you said, Tim, you said you were a little confused about the reports of some missiles being shut down while others were being activated. To my mind, and there are these reports where missiles were activated in Soviet Ukraine in October of 82, I've interviewed a man named David Schur, who, like Bob Salas, was a missile launch officer at Minot Air Force Base, not Malmstrom, in the mid-60s, who said that his missiles were temporarily activated while a UFO was, according to his guards, topside, moving from missile to missile. I'm of the opinion that, you know, there was no attempt to launch those missiles. At the very least, they were simply trying to scare the hell out of the people down in the capsule, and, you know, the reports would make their way up the command. So there would be a very serious situation reported by the Pentagon, you know, that, hey, not only did they shut them down in this case, but these things were preparing to launch for a few seconds. And that's exactly what apparently happened in Soviet Ukraine. So this, I think I mentioned a little bit earlier, this Russian article that appeared 2 weeks ago, it's posted at English translation is posted at UFO Chronicles website. If one Googles recent Russian article about UFO sightings at Soviet and American nuclear sites, or just some number of those words, recent Russian article UFO, you'll see this article that I had translated. I had the reporter help me translate it in English. where she's talking about the missiles being activated there. Her opinion, and her name is Inessa Kornienko, she agrees with me. I think maybe Bob agrees that whoever were in the UFOs were basically trying to figure out how to launch the missiles, and they did shut down the launch sequence, but they gained that knowledge. You know, they learned how these missiles can be activated and shut down, so there was no effort really to launch them, just to learn more about them and probably at the same time scare the hell out of the people involved.
Right, exactly, yeah, because if they wanted to launch them, they would have launched them already by now, so,
right.
You know, I mean, they can keep shutting them down. Well, like you said, they could really seriously damage them probably to the point where they'd be unusable. So who knows really exactly what their deal is. But that's really kind of what we're all in this for, right? Trying to figure out what their deal is. I just want to ask you, Robert Hastings, now you've been doing this UFO nuke research for a while. What's been the reaction of the UFO community to your stuff? Because it's pretty groundbreaking material as far as, you know, you've done a lot of legwork and dug up a lot of witnesses on your own here and sort of pioneering a whole new realm of UFO study. So I'm just sort of interested on a sociological level what the reaction of the people in the UFO community has been to your stuff.
The overwhelming response that I've gotten is positive. And my target audiences really are people outside of ufology. When I'm at colleges and universities, I always contact the local media, which opens up the program to local communities, large and small, in addition to the student bodies. So I have a pretty good cross-section of ages, educational backgrounds, and so on. And, you know, people, whatever their preconceptions might be when they walk in the door, 90 minutes later, they're sitting there very stunned looking and with their mouths open because I've just presented document after document and witness testimony after witness testimony talking about UFOs at nuclear weapons sites. So, you know, if people let me lay out my case, they're all overwhelmingly favorably impressed.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, well, I've been since we first talked 3 years ago, for sure. We're pretty close to the close. Let's sort of reiterate here this press conference you guys have coming up. September 27th, 2010, in Washington, D.C., at the National Press Club. You know, give a little preview of what you're going to have there. Just some witnesses. Bob, obviously, you're going to be there. Robert, you're going to be talking about your research and try and engage the press a little bit about this, right?
I want to make sure we mention the Robert's website. It's www.ufohastings.com, mm-hmm. And there we're requesting donations to fund this effort. We're doing this as a grassroots effort. We're not connected with any organization. We don't have a sugar daddy supporting it. So we're asking the public to get involved and donate some funds so we can make this thing happen. Robert, I'll let you kind of summarize the kinds of witnesses that we'll have.
I think we don't want to give away too much. I've talked about Bob's Jameson, who was the targeting officer who helped bring up the missiles at Malmstrom where they were shut down at Oscar Flight when Bob Salas was involved. He's going to be one of the participants. I'll mention Colonel Charles Holt. He's best known for his involvement in the Bentwaters incident, walking around through the woods with a team of security policemen, chasing objects that, among other things, one of the objects they saw in the sky moved toward the Bentwaters weapons storage area and shone down beams of light into it. And we've got other witnesses, eyewitnesses, and persons who can attest to officers who were aware of missiles being shut down at Malmstrom. One gentleman who was out working on a missile site when a disc-shaped object came over his head and hovered, scaring the hell out of his group. Those are some of the people who will be talking at the press conference. I don't want to give away too much until the press conference itself, but as Bob said, we are going to have press kits that will be some 30 to 40 pages in length talking about not only these incidents of the participants that they were involved in, but other incidents throughout the Cold War era. All of our witnesses have sworn out legal affidavits. Those will be presented in the press kit. And so it's going to be a very credible presentation, and we're hoping that, you know, unlike some of the other conferences that I won't name who had less credible offerings, these are all rock-solid witnesses with military credentials who operated weapons of mass destruction talking about UFOs. So I think our presentation will be unique among the ones that have been held there.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so that's the view of the media. I mean, obviously, I know that's the case from talking to you guys and talking about the witnesses and stuff. I'm concerned just about the malaise of the media with this subject, you know, with, especially down there at the press club. But I'm hoping that it's a go and that it works out well. I think the press conference is a great idea, too, because what I've been saying for a while, and I'm sure you guys can share this point of view, is that to emphasize the national security implications of the UFO mystery is really important, and in some segments of ufology don't do that aspect of it. You know, they see it as the brothers of light coming to help us or something like that, and that may be the case, but, you know, sticking with the facts that we have as it is right now, there's definitely a national security implication to what you guys are talking about, and that might be the best way to sort of engage the public and the media into giving this thing a whole new, fresh look.
That's a very good summary. Tim, I agree with you 100%. There's a nexus here, as I said, not just the UFO phenomenon, but the nuclear weapons problem that we've got worldwide, and also the extreme secrecy that we've got in government. Yeah, we've got a president that said we're going to have more open government. Well, we want to see him take some action in that regard on this issue. So hopefully this is going to be enough to interest the mainstream media. That's what we're trying to get.
Now, have you guys heard from anyone outside of the people you've talked to that are, you know, that are in the military that sort of are like whistleblowers? Have you ever heard from anyone, you know, within the government that, with knowledge of this sort of situation, showing concern over it or knowledge of the situation?
Speaking for myself, the great majority of my witnesses were in the field and involved in the experiences. It seems like the higher the information is kicked up, people get more and more tight-lipped.
Yeah.
I always laugh when I read online or hear on TV programs about people who have these high-level sources who know everything about UFOs and every detail about what the Pentagon and the CIA are thinking. Well, every now and then you get a rare hit like that. Victor Marchetti, who an ex-CIA official who talked about UFO activity and rumors of crashed UFOs and so on. But most of those rumors and stories and alleged sources, that's just too good to be true. People who shoot their mouths off at that level just don't end up, they don't stay in their jobs long. So there are rare exceptions, but you have to deal with the witnesses you have. When you have highly credible and courageous people like Mr. Salas and the people that I've talked to, you know, that's, you're already more than halfway there in terms of establishing credibility for the subject. And if you want to hold out for the highest levels of the Pentagon or the CIA coming forward, I think you'll be waiting a long, long time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, now, UFOs and Nukes is the book from Robert Hastings. The website with a lot of information there on the press conference as well is ufohastings.com. Aside from the press conference, anything you got cooking, Robert, that you might want to mention, speaking engagements or follow-up to the book or articles that you're working on or anything, you know, that you want to plug here?
It appears that I'm going to be at Oxford University in England in November, a very prestigious school, obviously. The school itself doesn't want to touch my subject matter with a 10-foot pole, but there's an alumnus who is going to rent a hall for me on campus. Another benefactor, another sponsor is flying me to England. So apparently I'm going to land at Oxford and hopefully create a stir. We'll see. That's the big thing for the fall for me, in addition to the press conference.
Oh, that would be great, because maybe then you can open up some new sources over in the UK as well, given their nuclear arsenal. Yeah,
and I'm just hoping to avoid the eggs and tomatoes.
And Bob, what about you? Obviously, the press conference is Faded Giants. That's still available for people, or is that out of print now?
No, it's print on demand, I think.
Oh, great! So
you can still order it through Amazon.com. I don't have any major events planned that I know of at this point, other than my summer vacation, which I'm looking forward to.
I bet.
Good for you.
Sounds good. Well, I can't thank you gentlemen enough for coming on the show. I know it was sort of last minute, but I'm really glad we managed to get it together and get both of you here on the program. Robert, it was a thrill to catch up with you again and talk to you about the UFO nuke connection and all this new sort of different areas of stuff that we hadn't got the chance to cover before. And I'm really happy that the book's out, and I hope folks go out and pick it up, because it's, I'm sure, just packed with information. And be sure to check out our previous interview at BOA Audio. And, of course, the website UFOHastings.com is where folks can find out more about you. Bob Salas, Robert has already said it numerous times, but I'm going to personally here commend you for your courage and stepping up to the plate and telling people your story. I know that I'm sure that you've had to deal with all kinds of naysayers and troublemakers over the years who are not happy with what you've had to say, but you've stuck to it, and I really respect and appreciate that, and I wish you both the best of luck with this press conference in September. Hopefully the mainstream media will wake up to this situation and give it a serious look and start to alert the public about what's really going on here with UFOs and nuclear bases. So thanks again for coming on the show, guys.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 5. Big, big, super huge thanks, of course, to Robert Hastings and Bob Salas for coming on the show. Be sure to check out Robert Hastings' website, www.ufohastings.com, for more information on their press conference scheduled for September 27th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio listener feedback, but this episode is so fucking late to get to you guys out there that I'm going to skip listener feedback this week. I will definitely bring back listener feedback next week because I have two awesome emails from BOA Audio listeners, one who is over in Shanghai, stunningly enough, and he has some great things to say. So we're going to definitely have listener feedback next week for you. I already had the stuff picked out, but I want to get things rolling along here. If you want to get in touch with me for BOA Audio listener feedback or just to, shoot the breeze, you can contact me via boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to Banal of America, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com and click the contact button. Or if you are a forum fan, join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground, theusofe.com. Here's the URL once again, theusofe.com. I'm also on MySpace, Twitter, and Facebook. Find me on there if you are a part of those social networks. Before we get into the thanks part of the show, I will drop some knowledge on you hardcore BOA Audio listeners who are tuning in here at the end of the show. This week's episode is number 526, which means we are closing in fast and furiously on the season finale of BOA Audio Season 5. I've been kind of debating on what number to end the season on. Some years it's 31, other times it's 33. I think last year was 34, but I'm aiming this year for 33, which means we've got 7 more programs left here in Season 5. Of those 7, the next 3 are already either taped, scheduled, or on the verge of being scheduled. So they're pretty much locked in, which means we have 4 slots left. I'm going to try and do it like we did it last year with the final 4 of Season 4. This time around, the final 4 of Season 5. If I'm feeling ambitious, maybe the final 5 of Season 5, but who knows? Who knows? Of course, the final run of guests will be the cream of the crop, the A-lists in the world of esoterica, leading up to hopefully what will be a grand slam of a season finale here on BOA Audio Season 5. So that's a little peek behind the curtain on what's going on here with the program, keeping you informed on what to expect as the summer of 2010 unfolds and we head to the season finale of BOA Audio Season 5. Now let's do the thanks portion of the show. Allow me to tip my cap to the outstanding BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, A.M. Murphy, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist, Andy Carolan, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. We've gotten just a ton of really constructive feedback from the folks who have been checking out BOA 2.0. So if you haven't gone to the website, I presume you have by now. I don't know how you would not have noticed BOA 2.0, but it's there, and we want your feedback on it. We're making some changes over the course of the summer. Don't worry, folks who have been writing to us with constructive criticism. We are hearing your pain, and we are trying to find ways to satisfy everybody who visits the website. So stay tuned to BOA 2.0. It's an organic, changing beast, my friends, and it frightens me. I'll be honest, it scares me.
And, of course, go to Been All of America for awesome writings from the BOA staff. I don't have time to preview them all right now. They're great, and there's tons of them. So you can find that app in All of America as well. We say it all the time. It should be on a bumper sticker. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Been All of America, you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. If you're listening this far into the program, you know what comes next. It is the call for donations. I did not hide the hidden call for donations in the midst of the program this week. We just did not have the time to fool around with that stuff. But I'm hoping to do it soon, as we addressed at the end of last week's program. Nonetheless, I need donations, folks. Let's face it, I'm hurting here financially. Times are tough. Putting this show together is wearing me down. And as the website grows and the program grows, trust me, my friends, the costs of this whole enterprise grow exponentially with the audience. So how can you help us out? That's simple. There's two ways to donate to us. If you're into the online scene and you don't mind using that methodology, you just go to Been All of America and click the PayPal button. Let's say you don't trust the internet and you want to donate via snail mail. Here's how you can do that. You send your donations to Tim Benall, B as in Boston, I-N-N-A-L-L, Tim Benall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass., 01866. And the way to spell Pinehurst, if you're a little confused, is P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. So all together now, it's Tim Benall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass., 01866. I say this all the time, folks, but I mean it. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards keeping BOA and BOA Audio up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Next week on the program, it's going to be a wild one, folks. Our guest is William H. Kennedy, and I'm simply calling the topic Occult Observations. The gist of it is William H. Kennedy has been studying the esoteric for like the last 30 years. He's written a bunch of different books, contributed a lot of different articles to various publications. He's hardcore, and he's got an exhaustive website. It's williamhkennedy.com. Just once you go down that rabbit hole, you're never going to get out. He contacted me a long, long time ago. I just never had a chance to talk to him until now, and I was just tremendously entertained by the conversation. I haven't sat down to edit the interview yet, so I can't really even begin to touch on all the points we talk about in the interview, but some of the rough tent poles of the conversation are the satanic elements of the Catholic Church, his friendship with the late Father Malachi Martin, the impending emergence of a New World Order, his thoughts on UFOs, secret societies, hidden occult messages in the mainstream, and tons more dark elements of esoterica. Altogether, it really is quite an episode of BOA Audio. You definitely want to tune in next week. William H. Kennedy's Occult Observations on BOA Audio Season 5. And on that note, we close the book on this week's edition of the program. 1,000 apologies for the problems in getting the program out to you folks over the last week or so. I try to avoid the week-to-week scheduling, and that's why things go haywire when guests can't appear at the last minute. It was crazy time. Nonetheless, thank you so much for tuning in this week, folks. We're going to try and get back onto a normal schedule here throughout the summer as we can see the finish line of BOA Audio Season 5. And that is, of course, thanks to all you great folks out there who are fueling the BOA machine. The BOA Audio listeners, you guys are the best. Thank you for making this program a part of your esoteric audio playlist. I hope all my American friends out there had a great 4th of July. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.